Support for GPR streaming comes from Port of Entry, a podcast from KPBS and PRX. Border people often inhabit this in-between space created by the separation and collision of two cultures. The Port of Entry podcast tells personal stories from this place, stories of love, hope, struggle, and survival from border crossers and other people whose lives are shaped by the wall. Find Port of Entry on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Details at portofentrypod.org.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. National polling and the matchup between President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden is telling us that Biden has a lock on winning the presidency. But polling numbers are not election numbers, a fact that we learned in 2016. So the question many people have right now is this going to be deja vu all over again? After 2016, Democrats have been working hard to avoid that. But what did they do exactly? Professor of Political Science Seth Maskett tells us in his new book, Learning from Loss, the Democrats 2016 to 2020, they have been working to figure out how to win the White House. Seth Maskett, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. So Seth, you write in a book that you started out thinking that you were going to be writing about how the Republicans were going to be tackling this question. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I had started this idea back in 2016, and it was such an unusual year, and the Republicans had such an unusual nomination process for where they ended up with Donald Trump as their front runner. And it seemed at the time like they were destined for a loss that year. I mean, you know, Trump was trailing Hillary Clinton most of the year in the polls, and I was just figuring once they lose that election, they're going to have a very interesting discussion about how they got to that point, you know, losing an election they didn't need to lose, essentially not exerting a whole lot of control over the nomination process. Of course, you know, things came out very differently, and it was Democrats who ended up having the conversation. And that was a conversation I was really interested in tracking over a four-year period, just, you know, how a party kind of interprets an election loss and then uses that information to pick its next nominee.
Your book is pretty much a conversation, a question about who controls the party. Is that central?
Yeah, that's really important. There's a number of books on this. One of the influential ones that I was kind of following here is a book called The Party Decides that came out back in 2008. Essentially made the argument that, you know, party insiders or elites, whatever you want to call them, you know, just a collection of activists and office holders and other prominent partisans essentially make a lot of the decisions on the voters' behalf. That is, they look at the candidates long before anyone starts voting, decide who they like, and then endorse those people and just like steer a lot of resources towards their favorite candidate. You know, we saw this in 2000, where, you know, a lot of Republican leaders well in advance of the primaries had leaned toward George W. Bush, and just sort of it signaled to everyone else that this was not, you know, if you're a Republican, this was not the year to run, that the party had already converged behind a favorite. And sometimes the party does that. And that did not happen on the Republican side in 2016, where party insiders just didn't pick a favorite. So I was curious going into this research project, you know, just how much power the party still has. Can they still pick leaders, or have they kind of leaned back and just, you know, they just let the voters do the deciding in the primaries and caucuses?
Well, in 2016, wasn't the conventional wisdom was that Jeb Bush was going to be the party nominee, that he had lined up all of the cash and all of the endorsements, and that he was going to just get through the primary to get to the general election. And then, of course, Donald Trump happened. And so he was able to hijack or hack the party and use the base to reject Jeb Bush and become the nominee.
Yes, partially, except if you look at the people who usually endorse in Republican presidential nominations, you know, the governors and members of Congress and, prominent Christian group leaders and others, they largely stayed silent in advance of that. I mean, some of them backed Jeb Bush, some of them backed Rubio, a few backed Ted Cruz. They were kind of very split, and a lot of them just didn't signal a preference at all. So it seemed like, you know, back in, say, 2015, you know, I would say that the smart money was on Jeb Bush or someone like him to get the nomination. But
right. Yeah.
The party didn't exert a lot of effort to make him get that nomination.
Well, the chattering class was talking about how we were going to have a presidential race between a Bush and a Clinton again. And they were upset about that and throwing up their arms. No one had seen Trump coming. And so the party process was totally just reinvented with the way that Trump hijacked that party. And Clinton ended up being the nominee for the Democrats that year, and she came in with an aura of inevitability. So how powerful was that?
Right. And yeah, that was a case where the party really did give a very loud preference there. Like they had said long before 2016, you know, pretty much every Democratic office holder, every Democratic member of Congress and a lot of other office holders and a lot of other prominent labor union officials and everyone else all signaled pretty strongly in advance that Hillary Clinton was their choice. And, you know, it scared a lot of other possible candidates out of the race. And, you know, they did end up with her as the nominee, but it ended up being substantially more competitive than people thought. I mean, Bernie Sanders is the kind of candidate who doesn't necessarily listen when, you know, party insiders tell him to back out. And he stayed in that race. And he didn't win the nomination, of course, but he did better than a lot of people expected. And so that was another question I had going into this, is just, you know, how much power does the party have to force other people out of the race? You know, how much power does someone like Bernie Sanders, who has kind of his own enthusiastic following, have to, you know, to kind of influence the course of events there? I was interested to see just how much that happened.
So the question seems to be, is the nominee that we have, Joe Biden, today, is the nominee the result of popular support bubbling up from the bottom, or is it from coming from the big donors and the people who are control party mechanisms? Is it anointment from on high, or is it somewhere in the middle?
Right. So it was interesting because in some ways it was a little bit of a measure of both, but I had followed. So for the purpose of this book, I spent several years talking with a number of political activists, some Democratic Party activists, people who get involved with presidential campaigns in the early states, in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada, and some in Washington, D.C., just to get a sense of what they were thinking about why Hillary Clinton lost, what they were thinking about the 2020 nomination and who they liked. And they were undecided for a lot early on, but by the end of 2019, most of them were leaning toward Joe Biden. It wasn't like an overwhelming consensus. Like Sanders still had a substantial amount of support among the people I was talking to. Elizabeth Warren did to some extent. But for the most part, people were, by the end of that year, leaning toward Biden. And I looked at a number of ways, you know, people who donate to the Democratic Party and donate to candidates. That's like party-leaning money. That was leaning Biden. There were just a lot of signals that Biden was a choice that the party had made. He was also, in some ways, kind of an easy choice because he had been leading in Democratic public opinion polls throughout 2019. You know, that is, they weren't, you know, if the party was deciding, they weren't necessarily deciding something that voters weren't comfortable with. But it seemed like this was a choice that you know, party insiders made.
But when you look at the process, or you relive the process, you know, remember, it didn't feel that secure in the very beginning. Just go back to February of the year, and when we had the Iowa caucuses, and how the winner of the Iowa caucus, I mean, it was Pete Buttigieg, South Bend mayor, Then he narrowed out Bernie Sanders, and Bernie Sanders will tell you he actually won. And then Elizabeth Warren came in third, and then it was Joe Biden who came in fourth.
Yeah, and then he came in fifth in New Hampshire, I think.
He was all declared dead at that point. People thought that Joe Biden was no longer, he didn't have it.
That was one of the really stunning things, is how little Iowa and New Hampshire ended up mattering to this whole process. In many ways, these were, it's funny, because throughout 2019, you had a lot of discussion among Democrats about how this is an incredibly large and incredibly diverse field of candidates. And maybe, you know, the preferences of Iowa and New Hampshire shouldn't matter all that much. And it might end up that we get different winners of each of the early four contests. And they were in some ways treated as kind of like beauty contests. Like, this was a way, you know, candidates could show their strengths, but they weren't necessarily going to determine who gets the nomination. And one of the places you really saw something interesting was right around the time of the South Carolina primary, when all of a sudden, Biden started doing well there, and suddenly a lot of party, people within the party, prominent Democratic leaders, Jim Clyburn, Representative Clyburn in South Carolina, and a bunch of others, all of a sudden jumped in and started endorsing Joe Biden. Like, he did well in South Carolina. Something like 30 prominent Democratic office holders jumped in and endorsed him. And immediately, Pete Buttigieg drops out, Amy Klobuchar drops out. Shortly after that, Elizabeth Warren drops out. And that was really, that was like a moment where you see the power of a party to make a difference. They weren't necessarily telling voters how to vote, but they were just kind of limiting their options. They're just saying, look, you have a choice now. It's Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden, pretty much.
Yeah, so all those people dropped out right before Super Tuesday. And we had already started early voting on Super Tuesday, and and people were voting for these candidates, and then they dropped out. And social media was like, I'm never going to early vote again. And now here we are. Everyone's rushing to early vote.
Yeah, same thing happened here in Colorado. We had a lot of early voting. And for a lot of candidates who weren't actually in it by the time Election Day came by.
So that was the phenomenon of people falling in line behind Joe Biden. The factionalism that we have seen people associate with the Democratic Party became softer.
I would say it is still there. I spend a chapter looking at, in this book, looking at factionalism within the Democratic Party, looking at how, you know, I look at people who donated to Sanders or Clinton back in 2016 and how they end up often splitting in Democratic primaries and governor's races in 2017 and 2018. I mean, you can see these kind of persistent sort of progressive versus establishment faction going forward for a while. And honestly, I think that's still there. I mean, there's still divisions within the party. There's still ideological splits within the party, but one of the lessons that a lot of prominent Democrats took from 2016 is that they lost because they were divided. And they are really very eager to demonstrate unity this year. One thing that has really helped, honestly, is President Trump and his campaigning style. The one thing that a lot of different Democrats, from, say, Joe Biden to AOC, seem to be able to agree upon is that they want Trump out of the White House. That is a great unifying force in the party right now. And they're willing to look past a lot of their own interests and just for the sake of getting that victory. I think it's going to be it would be harder after that, though.
All right, so they called a truce with the factionalism in the Democratic Party. And after November 3rd, will that truce go back to its usual, knives out sort of style of trying to get things done with Democrats? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Julie, I see you on the board. I'll get you on the air when we come back from the break. If you got a question or a comment about how the Democrats responded to their loss in 2016, give us a call. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The Democrats' decision to nominate Joe Biden as their presidential nominee in 2020 was hardly a fluke, but rather a strategic choice by a party that had elevated electability above all other concerns. In the book, Learning from Loss, it offers a unique insight into the Democratic Party at a moment of great uncertainty. We're speaking with the author of the book, Seth Maskett. He's a professor of political science and the director of the Center on American Politics at the University of Denver. And you can call in if you got a question or a comment about where we are right now in American politics and how you felt after 2016. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to Julie on the phones. And Julie, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is that it seems to me in 2016 and again now, Democrats are allowing Republicans, specifically Donald Trump, to control the narrative. He slanders the Democratic Party, the Democratic beliefs. He assigns, every candidate now refers to Democrats as socialists, and socialism being our party line, when yes, that may be a faction, but that's all it is. We allow it. We don't try to refute that or respond to it in any way. And, you know, if you want to flip that coin over, the Republican Donald Trump's philosophy is just flat out fascism. We could assign that label. But we don't.
Julie, thank you for the call. So, Seth Maskett, if you could talk about the power of the narrative and if how Joe Biden fits into that.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I was interested in her point there that, I mean, to some extent, the president is always going to have a lot of power to influence, you know, how the media are talking about politics. President, whoever the president is just has a big microphone and can always steer conversations in one direction or another. And him referring to Democrats as socialists, that's hardly a new invention. I mean, you know, Republicans have been accusing Democrats of socialists. You know, Nixon was doing that in the 50s, and it goes back at least that far. That doesn't mean it always works, right? I mean, that label is out there, and, you know, at least according to polls, Joe Biden is leading pretty substantially. One of the things I was trying to do in this book is figure out, you know, what, you know, how Democrats were, what narrative they were constructing about 2016, about why they thought they lost. And it was really, in many ways, kind of all over the place. Some of them said that the problem was the campaign. Some said that the problem was Hillary Clinton herself. She was a poor campaigner. Some said they had the wrong messaging. Some said it had something to do with, you know, quote unquote, identity politics, that, you know, Democrats were too focused on underrepresented minorities and not enough on working class whites. But a lot of these messages lean toward, they were panicking and they wanted to go with what they saw as the most electable candidate for 2020, regardless of whether they necessarily agreed with that candidate on most issues.
On the socialism question, it does seem like the Democratic response was Joe Biden. Joe Biden, who's a longtime Washington senator and insider and a moderate. And if you wanted someone, you could definitely say who's on a Democratic stage for the debates, who is not a socialist, that would be Joe Biden, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, that was at least one of the concerns that some Democrats had, is that they didn't, you know, they figured this election would be close. They kind of didn't want to take any chances, and they didn't want to have anyone who could be credibly branded as leaning towards socialism. And so, yeah, Joe Biden seems like a good alternative to that. What kind of surprises me is that, you know, the Trump campaign has continued to portray him as a socialist, or saying he's, you know, like a dupe for other socialists within the party or something like that. It's the messaging hasn't varied all that much. But I think even Biden himself said something like, "You're really calling me a socialist?" Like, he seemed kind of surprised by that and almost amused.
So the narrative, the powerful narrative of electability, being anointed with electability, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy if you could somehow get that that brand onto you. How powerful was that for Joe Biden?
So it was it's a really interesting cycle for that. There's a set of polls, if you look at, I think, a YouGov poll that were there before every presidential election over like the last four presidential cycles. They've done this thing where they ask Democrats, if you had a choice in a presidential nominee, would you prefer someone who you agree with on most issues or someone who can win in November? You know, obviously, you generally want someone who can do both. But if you had to choose someone who agrees with you or someone who can win, what would you pick? And most of the time, Democrats say, I want someone who agrees with me. And it was completely reversed in leading into 2020, where Democrats overwhelmingly said they wanted someone who could win. They were willing to pay a price, basically. They were willing to give up on some things that they cared about to get a win. So that was very important. Now, I'd say once you start talking about electability, that's a really that's a very fuzzy issue. I spent a lot of time in the book talking about that. That's basically it's not your impression of who you would vote for. It's your impression of who other people would vote for. And so people end up, imposing a lot of stereotypes on that about, you know, who they think can win and who they think other voters would like. And some of that is accurate and some of that is really just a lot of guesswork there.
But the media has a role in creating that that halo of electability. And it seemed like George W. Bush was able to hang on to that.
Yeah, he was described. Yeah, I remember George W. Bush was really he was described as being electable. That was a that was one of his things that they I remember back at the time him being talked about as someone who could who was fairly conservative, but also could work well with other Democrats in his state and could also sort of unite a lot of different factions in the Republican Party and generally, you know, not scare people off.
And it was always like he's someone you could have a beer with, even though he didn't drink anymore.
Yeah, I never understood how that part worked. But yeah, but people found him not terrifying. So yeah.
But being able to capture that, and then the media has a major role in the postmortem of the election when you lose. I mean, in the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, everyone, they send the reporters into these cornfields into the Midwest to try and figure out what happened, or into the Rust Belt. And it does seem like with the reporting that they do, I mean, I see it as worthless because with it's not scientific. They go out, they interview a bunch of people and they cherry pick people that fits an already established narrative. They're not really telling you anything.
Well, yeah, and it's not necessarily, it's not very scientific at all. But in researching this book, I was surprised just how important these narratives are, that, you know, people need something to cling to, that when you have something like a presidential election across, you know, 50 states, there's so many moving parts and there's so many reasons why someone might vote one way as opposed to another. And particularly in 2016, which was so close. And, you know, you shift 80,000 voters into different states, you've got a completely different president. You know, almost any idea of what would have, you know, something else that could have happened, you know, so some narrative might be accurate to some extent. Like, you know, what if James Comey hadn't issued his report at the end of October? Or, you know, what if there hadn't been Russian interference or, you know, something like that? So, and people kind of, they cling to these narratives because they're really helpful for just boiling down a really complex set of events. I was surprised in following the media coverage after the 2016 election that, you know, political reporters also had a hard time figuring out why that election came out as it did. And instead of like converging on a narrative after a few weeks, which is what normally happens in a presidential election, they did not do that at all after 2016. They were actually clinging to more and more narratives as time went forward. So I don't think there's still any consensus about why Hillary Clinton lost in 2016.
But the postmortem, is it a bunch of people, do they go off and have a convention and sit around in hotel rooms and conference rooms and discuss all this, or is this done on the fly?
You know, sometimes there's a formal process. Like if you look at the Republican National Committee, actually after Mitt Romney lost in 2012, they actually put out a report. They put out this postmortem report commissioned by the RNC to actually state why they thought they lost. And they, you know, they came up with a number of reasons. They said basically we're alienating the immigrant community. We're alienating women, and we need to go in a different direction on some of these key issues and be a more inclusive party.
And then they threw it away.
They went totally the other direction for 2016. But Democrats didn't do anything quite so formal as that after 2016. But one of the things I do in this book is I follow the conversations among DNC members, among the Democratic National Committee, when they're meeting throughout 2018 to figure out if they need to change their nomination system. And they're arguing about superdelegates, and they're arguing about how to conduct caucuses and things like that. And they were, you know, still struggling with many of these issues as well. And they, you know, they never reached any consensus, but they were concerned that, you know, the party needed to be more open, that they needed to exert less control over the nomination process than they did back in 2016, and, you know, kind of let people express their preferences.
So when we come back from the break, I want to talk more about Iowa and New Hampshire and about this primary process. If what's another way of doing that, maybe a better way that would be more inclusive. And our phones are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're talking about Learning from Loss, a book about how the Democrats reacted to their loss in 2016 and how we arrived at 2020. Give us a call. We got a question, 833-877-8255. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR Podcast comes from Port of Entry, a podcast filled with cross-border stories from cross-border people like you. Port of Entry zooms in on some of the interesting and unexpected ways the U.S. and Mexico are inextricably linked, despite the wall running between us. From KPBS and PRX, Port of Entry is available now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Get details at portofentrypod.org.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies, speaking with Seth Maskett. He's professor of political science, director of the Center on American Politics. He's the author of Learning from Loss, the Democrats 2016-2020, talking about how the Democrats reacted to their loss to Donald Trump last go-around and how they're trying to fix it today. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255. 833-TPR-TALK. You know, Iowa, the caucuses, why is that? How did that become such a big deal? I'm thinking in 2016, when we had the Republicans in there trying to find out who was going to be their nominee, Ted Cruz won the Iowa caucus against, and Donald Trump came in second, and Donald Trump said the whole thing was fraudulent and should be thrown out and nullified. But still, Iowa caucus got it wrong.
Yeah. So, I mean, Iowa's just been important for a while simply because it's been important, because it's the first big contest. And so the media have devoted a lot of attention to it, and the candidates spend a lot of time there trying to do well and turn out their supporters. And honestly, like, you know, the winner of the Iowa caucus doesn't usually become, or doesn't necessarily become, the nominee. But, you know, it's usually seen that Iowa has a big winnowing effect, that, you know, if you don't do in like the top three or so, the candidates tend to drop out. That didn't, you know, obviously happen this year since, you know, Biden obviously lived on after a drubbing there. But a lot of other candidates did drop out shortly after that, and shortly after New Hampshire a week later. That, you know, if you're not going to do well there, and, you know, you don't have a lot of other things backing up your campaign, like a lot of money or name recognition or endorsements or anything like that, then it's just not going to happen at that point.
In your book, you write about the invisible primary. What is that?
Yeah, that's a term political scientists and some others have started using to describe that long period leading up to Iowa, It's essentially the period. It's called an invisible primary because it functions like a primary in that there are candidates who are winners and losers, but there's no actual voting occurring. It's essentially the time when candidates are going around visiting with activists and meeting reporters and giving speeches and doing debates, and they're trying to get people to donate to their campaign. They're trying to get prominent people in their party to endorse them, and some of them just don't get very far. I mean, you think about Democrats in this cycle, there were in the middle of 2019, there were about 24 people who were that officially declared their candidacy.
Sure, and everyone was talking about Beto O'Rourke. You could say that he won the invisible primary, but then he didn't go anywhere with it.
Well, I would say he lost. He was one of the people who lost the invisible primary. He dropped out long before the voting started occurring. Same with people like John Hickenlooper or Cory Booker or Kamala Harris. I mean, these are people who had some backing, but dropped out before anyone started voting because they just didn't see any way this was going to happen for them. That's what makes the invisible primary fairly powerful. It had already knocked about half the candidates out before any voting occurred.
All right, I'm going to go to a caller, and this is Catalina. And Catalina, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I was going to comment, and this goes along the lines with talking about Beto O'Rourke and other candidates that dropped out early. I think that the powers above at the DNC have really held back other candidates, and they don't utilize them in really understanding a lot of these minority votes that I think they're failing to get, especially the Latino vote. They don't spend the time and resources to understand the Latino community as a whole or other communities. So I think they end up alienating a lot of voters because the DNC is represented by a lot of very powerful, longstanding politicians. And it's the same problem with the Republican Party. I think they just took it too far with Trump.
All right, Catalina, thank you for the question. And let me get the reaction from Seth Maskin.
Yeah, I mean, I think this definitely was a concern. And this is something that people within the Democratic Party were wrestling with. I mean, Latinos are certainly a prominent voice within the Democratic Party and even on the DNC and among Democratic office holders. And, this was, something that they were considering. This was, in fact, I think you can find some people who came out of 2016 on the Democratic side worrying about identity. That is, they were worried that essentially a non-white candidate might alienate some white voters. I don't know. The evidence is not honestly all that strong for that. But it's one of those stereotypes about electability that really kind of sticks in people's heads and is hard to shake them. I mean, I had spoke to
even after Obama.
Even after Obama, surprisingly. Who wins, majority of the vote, twice in a row. And even then they were concerned, well, maybe he was an unusual case. And, would this necessarily work again? I think the 2016 outcome really shook them. And, I spoke.
So that's why they thought Biden was electable because he was able to, he was white, a white male, and, was hopefully be able to win back over Democrats that voted for Trump in 2016.
Exactly.
I'm going to go to Zach on the phones before I run out of time. Zach, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask a quick question about ranked choice voting. It's something that's become a bit more popular recently, but has certainly seen histories in things like caucuses. But I'm wondering why the Democrats specifically, but both parties in general, don't seem to really support ranked choice voting when it would arguably be the easiest way to get a clear idea of what most people are actually interested in seeing for their candidate.
Zach, great question. Thank you. So, Seth Maskett?
So, I think this is a really interesting idea. I think maybe not this cycle, but not too far in the future, I think the Democratic Party may be interested in trying ranked choice voting, maybe in some of their caucuses, maybe in some of their primaries. I think there's a few states that are interested in it. I think one of the concerns some Democrats have about it is that if you were, say, going into the Iowa caucuses having to doing ranked choice voting, and you have like a dozen candidates to choose from, You know, it might be hard for people to rank a dozen people. Not impossible, but it takes a lot of work. And, you know, some people worry that actually might depress turnout a little bit, that if people find the job too confusing. But on the other hand, it was, you know, there was a lot of interest in this race. And, you know, I think you honestly might have seen a very similar outcome with Joe Biden getting the nomination under, you know, no matter what sort of voting system was used this year. But I think there's a few states that might be interested in trying that.
So is there a star chamber that anoints who's going to be the nominee, or is it the choice of the people, or is it the result of a process that needs to be improved? How did we end up with Joe Biden?
I wouldn't exactly describe it as a star chamber, but I would say that prominent people within the party, I think, you know, Democratic office holders and interest group leaders and DNC members and others, they still exert a lot of influence. And when they can agree on something, they can have a lot of power over who party voters pick. I don't think they can completely ignore who party voters like. If they can't necessarily force them to accept a candidate that they won't accept, but they still have a lot of influence, and I think that really distinguishes them from the Republican Party right now. Because we saw in 2016, I don't think Republicans had a lot of power to dissuade voters from going a certain way. So the Democrats are looking like something like a strong party, where they still have some power to make decisions and see those decisions through.
But Donald Trump seems to be, so the Republican Party in 2016, before the primary, you know, they had their eyes set on someone like Jeb Bush, who was a party insider, and they had all had raised all this money and seemed like he was going to be the nominee. And then you had basically a revolt, a populist revolt with that party. So you do have opportunities for people to voice who they actually want to be their nominee. And it's not always pretty. We saw that with Bernie Sanders and his own populist efforts to become the presidential nominee for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, no, that was one of the interesting things in 2016 is that in many ways, like, you know, Donald Trump was the result of a more democratic process on the Republican side, where the party more or less sat back and said, okay, you voters, you figure it out. And they came up with Trump. And the Democrats did a much more kind of elite dominated process that resulted in Hillary Clinton. And then, you know, and then you get the election results there. So, you know, that was certainly something Democrats were thinking about going into 2020, is just how much control they should have and how much control they should be seen to have. And if that was, you know, one of the things they worry is that they look like they're too much in control, and that might scare some voters off.
So we're going to have an election on November 3rd. I don't know if you heard about that or not, but it's happening. And and right afterwards, one of the parties will be doing their own self-examination. Either one of them, they're going to have a lot of big questions to ask. What do you think needs to be the number one?
Yeah, well, I mean, there will be a huge question as to why the election came out as it did. I think, you know, if Republicans end up losing this year at the presidential level, I think there'll be a big debate within the party as to whether it had to be that way.
If there is still a party, there's no question.
Right.
There may not be a Republican Party on November 4th, depending on what happens.
Yeah, but, you know, I can imagine, you know, there'd be some who say we didn't need to lose this, that, you know, with a different president going after the virus in a different way, you might have gotten a different outcome. You know, most incumbent presidents get reelected.
Sure.
On the other hand, I think, honestly, Donald Trump will still be a big player in the party, even if he's to lose.
He says he could run again in 2024. Seth Maskett, thank you so much. Professor of Political Science at the University of Denver, author of Learning from Loss, the Democrats 2016-2020. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Ruben Garcia and Kathleen Creedon. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.